In Shell Beach, Louisiana, the oil spill starts to take its toll.
1 week puts you 5 months behind. 2 weeks, you're done. You're looking at bankruptcy. I mean, that's not BP's fault. That's mine. You know what I mean?
Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire.
She was compared to an ant, and she thought she was an ant. And she used music to overcome those rough times, and during those rough times told herself that someday it would get better.
This year's Oscar for Best Short Documentary went to a small film about a musician in Zimbabwe.
My prayers were to at least be seen as someone important in life, not to be seen as someone useless, not to be seen as someone who's a burden.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Oil continues to gush into the Gulf of Mexico. In Shell Beach, Louisiana, about 40 miles east of New Orleans, the fishermen's lives are on hold. Their oyster and shrimp boats are docked. Crab traps sit in front yards instead of in lake beds. This week, the residents of Shell Beach are bracing to see what's going to happen. Eve Abrams reports.
Shell Beach has always been a small community. It's just a narrow strip of land sandwiched between canals and lined with docks. Before Katrina, only about 400 people called Shell Beach home. Now the number has shrunk to 12. About half of them are gathered today next to a huge industrial fan at Campos Marina, an open-air store with a roof for shade, a freezer full of ice, and two ramps backing into the water. The men are talking about the oil spill. There's nothing much else to do since most local waters are closed for fishing. Rob Campo runs the marina with his dad. He says business has trickled down to almost nothing.
1 week puts you 5 months behind. 2 weeks, you're done. You're looking at bankruptcy. I mean, that's not BP's fault. That's mine, you know what I mean? But I didn't let a rig sink either.
On a normal day, Campos Marina begins selling live bait, ice, gas, and diesel at 6 a.m. It hasn't been as busy as it was pre-Katrina, when boats backed up along the canal to stock up. But they were getting there, and the busy season was just beginning. Warren Dudenheffer, known in these parts as Captain Dude, is one of Campo's regular customers. Years ago, he worked on an oil rig, but these days, he's a recreational charter fishing captain, and he's out of work.
Everybody had quit calling to book more charters and canceled a lot of them, and normally this time of the year, we'd be fishing every day. This is our main season right now. Hopefully they can get it stopped so that way we can get back to a normal life. And it's kind of like a hurricane sitting out there waiting to come ashore, and stressful just thinking about it and how long and what's going to be the outcome.
Dudenheffer steps away from the fan into the scorching sun and points out toward the Gulf and the oil and Breton Island, a bird sanctuary he likes to visit.
You can see all the pelicans. I was there, just so happened around this time of the year, right after Katrina, they were pecking through the shell, and then there's some you walk a little further down the beach, and there was some of them foot and a half tall. Just fluffy white little feathers, pin feathers, and that's what's going on out there right now, and it's a big concern.
Like Dudenheffer, Emmanuel Alfonso once worked for an oil company. Now he manages vacation homes for folks from Baton Rouge and New Orleans who come to Shell Beach on the weekends to fish. He brings me out onto the deck of a recently rebuilt house.
You ain't gonna believe the view you see from up here. The ground is pretty. When you get up here, it's beautiful. I've been living here all my life and didn't know how pretty it was. Watch when you get up here. Watch this. Look at this, it's beautiful.
We look out onto Biloxi Marsh, low ribbons of green land unfolding in calm bayou water.
What happens if the oil gets over this grass here and stays there, then the problem is the grass is gonna die. When the grass dies, there's nothing to hold the mud, then you got erosion, and you got nothing to stop the storm surges and all that. So we don't want the grass to die. Because that dies, that's it. We're history. You know, it's no more land.
Back at Campos Marina, Rob Campos' father, Frank, picks up two black and white composition notebooks. A battle with throat cancer has left his voice a little rough. He says the notebooks are where he keeps track of the credit he's extended to the fishermen he's known his entire life.
That's about $35,000 worth of credit that they can't pay. We had a really bad winter. there wasn't much crabs. I carried them through the winter, figuring this time of the year would be picking up. They're all good people. They just got their backs against the wall.
Frank Campo says if things would get back to normal, they would pay him back. But he doesn't see anything getting back to normal anytime soon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Eve Abrams in Shell Beach, Louisiana.
We'll be checking back with the residents of Shell Beach periodically to hear how the oil spill is affecting them. A few years ago, the West African country of Ghana did away with school fees. As a result, 600,000 more children flooded the school system. The change might be good for students, but it hasn't been easy for teachers. In Ghana, like most of Africa, teachers are often underpaid and undereducated, but they're seeing their class size and their workloads grow. Prue Clark spent the day with one teacher in the southern coastal village of Fosu. She brings us this installment of our series, A Day in the Life.
Very exciting.
It's 4 a.m. as Sylvia Naughty pushes back the sheet and greets the day. It's just becoming light outside as the pretty 36-year-old sweeps her tiny three-room apartment.
Good morning, Jesus.
Her modest concrete dwelling is one of several built to lure teachers like Naughty to this rural part of the country. In a rudimentary kitchen, Naughty begins preparing breakfast. She has no electricity or running water, so she starts a charcoal fire in a pit at her front door and boils water from a bucket she fills at a borehole once a week. She whips up donuts to sell at school to supplement her meagre teacher's salary. Next, it's time to wake the tiny bundle asleep in a bed in the living room.
Hello, Blessing. Hello, Inshira.
Three-year-old Pacho is Naughty's son. She was married briefly to his father. After the wedding, he revealed another wife and children. Polygamy is traditional here, but Naughty, a devout Christian, doesn't believe in it, and so she left. Only later did she discover she was pregnant. The English translation of her little boy's name is Blessing.
Are you ready to take in your tea?
Yes.
Come and sit down. Do you like some eggs?
No.
Today you don't like any eggs.
After breakfast, Naughty and a cheery Blessing bathe in a bucket and then dress. By seven, they're out the door.
Let's go. Be a good boy. I'll carry you. I'll carry you at my back.
Naughty drops Blessing at a nearby kindergarten and takes the 10-minute walk to work.
Are you going? Get your classroom. One. Two. Three. Hurry up.
Naughty's second graders take their seats in rows of old wooden desks. There's no glass in the windows to block outside noise, but 25 little faces are entranced. Naughty glows with warmth. She smiles and moves from desk to desk, enveloping the children in a motherly love.
Put your pencil down. Class 10.
First up, a class stretch.
Down, up. Forward stretch. Sideways stretch. Up.
Then it's singing.
One, two.
This is a good day. Only three of Naughty's 28 students are away. Often the class is much smaller. Parents will keep their children home if they can't pay for a child's lunch or for notebooks. Getting rid of school fees eliminates just one of the barriers parents face. Uniforms, shoes and books can all be out of reach of families surviving on a dollar a day.
How much is one exercise book?
For their level, this one is 700 each, and they are supposed to get 12 for the whole year.
700 Ghanaian cedis is about 8 US cents. One US dollar will buy all the notepads, pencils and erasers a child needs for a year.
One US dollar.
One US dollar.
Yes, and they can't afford it. This.
Teachers often dip into their own pockets. Just this morning, another student came to tell Sylvia she was an orphan and her uncle could no longer pay for her.
Because I was so much touched. So I promised I'll also help the little that I can.
Naughty spends about one-sixth of her pay on her students. She even has to buy her own chalk.
Oh, that one.
At lunch, children take a bowl and line up for stew. A local woman cooks the food and children pay about 10 cents each. That way the kids get at least one meal a day.
We have a lesson this afternoon.
Back at school, class resumes.
What one lesson we have this afternoon. Yes, Emmanuel. Mathematics. Clap for him.
Naughty's class is lucky. She's the first teacher they've had with graduate school training. Many teachers haven't even finished college. Some schools have to rely on high school seniors to do the teaching. Because of poor teaching in the past, Naughty's students are way behind their grade level. She's working hard to help them catch up.
I want someone to write the number 9 on the board for me. Seth wrote this. What is this? The letter P. This is the letter P. We want 9. I want someone to write better.
The influx of new students into Ghana schools has created a severe teacher shortage here. But there's little financial incentive to enter the profession. An overworked teacher with a graduate degree and 15 years of experience, like Naughty, takes home just $150 a month. That allows her to buy basic necessities, but save almost nothing.
So I feel undervalued because when I look at my friends, my colleagues who I completed a secondary school with, who are in the banks, they own their own cars, they have their own homes, and I don't have a car, neither do I have a bicycle even to ride on.
Ghana's teachers went out on strike for 10 weeks last year over salaries. The government agrees teachers are underpaid, but insists it can't afford to pay more. But Naughty says she's doing something more important than people who make more money.
I'm bringing up Ghana's future, the children who are our future.
That evening, it's time to prepare a dinner of smoked fish stew, plantains, and the cassava and yam dough called fufu that Ghanaians eat with every meal. Naughty and Blessing eat on stools outside.
Eat and grow fast for me. I want you to be a big man.
Sylvia Naughty has thought about leaving teaching. She worries she'll not be able to afford to give Blessing the same opportunities she had as the child of a middle-class businessman. But she loves her job. She recalls one of her first posts, an isolated fishing village where she and the children didn't even share a language. She brought in books and pictures and found a way to communicate with them.
I made an impact in the lives of the children. And I know they are going to come up with very good grades because of the foundation I give them. Through hard work and dedication, one can make something good out of children who think they can do anything.
By 6 o'clock, as the equatorial light fades, the family retires indoors. Naughty puts Blessing to bed and prepares her materials for tomorrow's class. For the World Vision Report, I'm Prue Clark in Fosu, Ghana.
Still to come on the World Vision Report, a solar engineer in India comes up with solutions that save power and marriages. Find out more after the break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. About 10 million people work as street vendors in India. A fourth of them are women, and that number's rising. Women vendors face hurdles the men don't. Sexual harassment, even violence on the job, are common. But life for these women is looking up, as Will Everett reports.
The slum market of Sundarnagari is the definition of chaos. The narrow streets are jammed with vendors hawking everything from kitchenware to used clothing. Customers have to compete with passing cars and rickshaws, and the tension is palpable. I've heard that women vendors have it tough here, and as I approach a woman jewelry vendor and ask her for an interview, her eyes widen with fear.
No.
No? She doesn't want to?
She bats her arm for me to go away. Just then a man in the crowd comes up and explains that she's afraid of my recorder.
They think that you hurt her.
I hurt her?
Yes, because of the electronic shock.
Like that?
Yes. It turns out the recorder resembles a taser. Last year, the police tried to move her to make room for a male vendor who wanted her spot. When she refused, she says they tased her. Eventually, she consents to talk.
I work here 12 hours a day. I have to support my daughter. Sometimes the police drive us out of here when they get a bribe or there's a government cleanup. But where are we supposed to go?
One place many women vendors are going is in a market across town on Tagore Road. Here the scene is no less chaotic, but one thing is different. The vendors are all women. This is the Ladies' Market, a project created by an organization called the Self-Employed Women's Association, or SEWA. The idea is to give women a secure place to sell their wares, free from aggressive male vendors and corrupt cops. One of the vendors is a middle-aged woman named Krishna, who makes beaded placemats. She started coming here when the market opened in 2009.
I've been doing this for 10 years. My husband has a heart condition and I have a young son, so it all depends on me.
Before she came here, she was selling her placemats in a slum market nearby. She says that to get a good spot with high visibility, she had to bribe the police with a cut of her earnings. She knows of women who've been beaten and raped by the police and by other vendors. She never encountered such violence herself, but she could never relax knowing that a cop or a competitor might push her out at any time.
In other markets, if someone tells you to go, you have to go. Now we have a secure place to sell our goods. Believe me, it's a relief.
It took 10 years for SEWA to get permission from the city of Delhi to operate a market strictly for women. Dina Sangha, SEWA's director of outreach, says that city officials were in denial about the problems faced by women vendors. That's because most of the issues raised concern members of the city's police force.
Women vendors are subject to a lot of harassment, especially from the police. They're sometimes told that they have to provide sexual services for prized locations in the market, and many of them do it because their livelihoods depend on it.
But in late 2008, the city yielded, rezoning the market on Tagore Road for women only. Krishna opens a set of beaded drink coasters, showing off her handiwork. She says the only thing wrong with the ladies' market is that it runs only on Sunday. She hopes that will change. On the other hand, it's gotten a lot of buzz, especially with tourists.
I can make a lot more money here. People are curious to see what it's all about. On a good day, I can make about $20. At the other market, I'm lucky if I make half that.
I tell her about the woman at the other market, the one who thought I was going to tase her. She says life is hard for everyone in Delhi, especially with thousands of vendors fighting for limited space. We all live a hand-to-mouth existence, she adds, and don't have time to fight for our rights. She says it's good to have someone on her side. And then the conversation abruptly ends as Krishna turns away to greet a potential customer. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Delhi, India.
A market for women is the kind of solution Harish Handi might have thought up. He's been tackling problems in India for years. The solar engineer founded a company called Selco Solar. It brought solar lighting to more than 100,000 Indian homes. Now, Harish Handi has started something new. It's an incubation lab, a technology center located in the middle of nowhere near a cluster of rural villages. Harish and his colleagues wanted to hear directly from villagers about what kind of technology they needed to improve their lives. The first problem the villagers presented was pretty simple. It was about cooking. Most women in rural India use primitive wood-burning stoves. They spend hours each day gathering wood, and the stoves fill their kitchens with smoke, a huge health hazard. So Harish and his colleagues worked on a solution.
First, we learned that we have no clue, and we've literally burnt our fingers in many cases, because we are a sustainable energy company and look at sustainable energy sources, right? Many years ago, we thought, okay, let's do solar cooker. And then you start looking at, you are pushing the boundaries of culture of cooking. In some cases, for example, people say, I like the smell of wood in my rice or in my bread.
So the team developed a new stove that still uses wood, but much less. And it creates much less smoke that's now funneled outside the house. Harish and his team weren't surprised by the villagers' request for a new kind of stove. But they were surprised one morning when two women walked into the lab.
And they said, we have a problem that we live in a monsoon belt where it really pours during the rains. And we are day laborers. We only have two sets of clothes. And so what happens in the monsoons is we are not able to dry our clothes fast enough, which leads to the growth of fungus because it does not dry and it smells. And that leads to our husbands cheating on us.
Well, I bet you never expected to hear this kind of complaint. How interesting that these women came to your lab to tell you about this problem and they wanted you to come up with a solution.
Right, and no amount of survey really would have come up with this problem. And they will never come to an urban area lab and tell you the problem. Nor would they tell to a student who's going on a temporary two-day assignment or three-day assignment.
How is it that, how do you get these women to be comfortable coming into the lab and telling you stories like this?
There's a couple of things. One is the lab is based out of the village. So they've started to think it's part of their life, or it's an institution part of their life. Secondly, we have quite a few of the people who work in the lab from the villages. So people feel comfortable that it's one of them is working in the lab, and it's something that is very personal, and they can come up with these personal problems and talk to them. The issue only is sometimes they would like to speak to women, and we have, for example, women employees here whom they can actually come and sit and talk to them. So it's purely trust and level of comfort, exactly.
So did you come up with a solution for these women?
Oh, not yet. Not yet.
Have an idea?
We have an idea, but for example, on a same note, we had a different problem there was a problem for drying bananas in the summer, during the monsoons. And people used to lose a lot of those crops. So we came up with this hybrid dryer. Hybrid in the sense that it uses solar during the summertime and using biomass during the monsoons. And so use that to dry bananas so that they can sell it. But the issue with that is the clothes have smell of dried wood when they are dried. So we've not come up with a complete solution, but we are trying, yes.
I know that you focus a lot on solar-powered lighting, and that one of the goals of solar-powered lighting is to help children study at night because they have no electricity. But many right. parents are keeping their children out of school to work with them or to help them out on the farm. I understand you have found a way to tackle this education problem with solar energy.
That's a very developing country problem in a sense that people use kids as labor force. And what we did was we looked at what would incentivize them to send their kids to school. And electricity was one of them. We installed solar panels on top of a school. And we found out batteries which were less than the weight of a tiffin box. So a child could carry it easy. The lights were installed in the house. The child would take the battery, go to the school, plug it into the solar station in the school. The battery would get charged so that he or she could have better light at home in the night. That was a very critical incentive for the parents to actually send their kids to school.
What a great idea. Is that working?
Let me frankly, our success rate has been 50%, and that's what we said, at least 50%. It's much better than zero. We started with a small thing that's 300 kids. So, I mean, you're talking of now 150 kids going, but I think it's such a replicable model that we would like to do for around 100 schools in the next 6 to 8 months.
Harish, you've partnered with the D-Lab at MIT, and that's a lab that focuses on solutions for the developing world. And I understand you have a few MIT students coming out to intern at your incubation lab out in India this summer. What do you hope they'll be able to accomplish there? Or is this more about what the students can learn?
No, it's two-way. It's absolutely two-way. So what we are planning, what we do normally with interns from outside is, because we also have a tie-up with a very local engineering school, we would partner each student from abroad with one local engineering student so that you also have the local knowledge, come up with a set of problems that people have asked us, can you provide a solution, and put them on the plate of these kids together. They start working on a project that not only they work during their 3-month stint, but come back to D-Labs here in MIT and keep working on it until they find a solution. So it's a two-way. One, they learn about what the problems are, start looking at the world and the poor in a much different way, while we benefit from the great knowledge they have, as well as the facilities that they would utilize when they come back.
Now, this rural incubation lab, as you call it, is pretty young. It hasn't been operating for very long.
Right.
How will you measure success?
Selco itself is a 15-year enterprise. And for us, even if we light one house, it's a big success. And you say that even if we can come up with one solution per year, though I'm sure we'll come up with more solutions, one solution that directly impacts the quality of life of the poor, we will term it a big, big success.
Harish Handi is the co-founder and director of Selco Solar and the founder of the company's Rural Incubation Lab in India. Harish, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Peggy. Thank you. Thank you very much.
In Egypt, women are speaking up for themselves. Egyptian women say they're being sexually harassed. It happens daily as they simply walk along the streets. Daniel Estrin has this story from Cairo on how women are fighting back.
Molly, not her real name, is a 20-something-year-old American. She works with African refugees in Cairo. And she says she gets verbally harassed by men on the street here every day.
It's just the most cowardly thing.
Molly doesn't want to use her real name because she doesn't want to run into trouble with the Egyptian authorities. The government here is particularly sensitive to criticism that could deter tourism. Molly says she's pretty thick-skinned and dresses conservatively, but despite that, she's even experienced physical harassment.
You walk by, you have plenty of room, and they're putting out their pinky as they walk by so that the tip of their pinky can stroke the side of your thigh. I mean, it's just gross, and I've called out some of it, and they just, I don't know what you're talking about, ma'am.
It was stories like this from foreigners willing to speak out that got Nihad Abu El-Komsan wanting to know more. Abu El-Komsan chairs the nonprofit Egyptian Center for Women's Rights, and she too has been harassed.
Someone stopped with his car, and this is a bad sign. He didn't say anything, just stopped beside me in his car. I consider this is very insulting behavior. It means you're telling her you are a prostitute and let us make a deal.
In 2008, Abu El-Komsan's organization polled 1,000 women from nearly every area of the country, young and old, conservative and liberal, Egyptian and non-Egyptian.
It shocked us what is happening in people's behavior. We are annoying each other.
Here's what they found. 98% of foreign women visiting Cairo had experienced sexual harassment. And about 8 in 10 Egyptian women said they too had been harassed on the street. The study also found that almost 2/3 of Egyptian men actually admitted to harassing women. When asked why, many of them said the reason is very simple. The women they harass are immodestly dressed. But Abu El-Komsan says her research shows otherwise.
70% of veiled women were harassed.
When the study was published, Egyptian women began to speak out more about their experiences. Like these two young women speaking in a Cairo cafe.
One day, something happened to me. I was with my mother, so I was not even alone. And there was someone who came close to me and he catched my leg. He didn't touch, he catched me. Do you imagine?
It doesn't have to be touching. It can be words. And it could happen in a decent suburb. Every time I go out, I hear words. This is every day. Every day.
So why is sexual harassment so widespread in Egypt? Abu El-Komsan cites increasing numbers of men who are unemployed and spending too much time on the streets with nothing to do. And others point to the large number of unmarried men in Egypt. Men are expected to be financially secure before they get married. And with the rising costs of living, many can't afford it. And since relationships outside marriage aren't accepted in Egypt, many men say they're sexually frustrated. Like 31-year-old Tayeb Muhammad.
I do sometimes say things to girls on the street. I'm not proud of it. I say, you are pretty. You have nice hair. Give me your number. A lot of guys do more than this.
Shortly after the Women's Rights Center published its findings, Egyptian officials tried to brush off claims of rampant harassment in the streets. Then, a man in Cairo reached through his car window and groped a woman on the street. That woman happened to be a volunteer with the Egyptian Center for Women's Rights. She brought charges, and the man was eventually sentenced to 3 years in jail. It was Egypt's first legal case against sexual harassment. And a few weeks ago, Egypt's deputy speaker of the parliament spoke up. He said legislation was needed to protect women from, quote, savage levels of harassment. These developments give Abu al-Khamsan hope.
What happened is something like a revolution. We break the taboo, we allow two women to talk, and we break their silence. So we are very satisfied with it.
Abu al-Khamsan proudly points out a bulletin board that's right next to her desk. It's covered in Egyptian newspaper clippings about sexual harassment. She hopes all the exposure will send a clear message. If you want to make a compliment, she says, keep it to yourself. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in Cairo.
Said that gal Dewberry, ain't it the truth? Life is cash.
And now we say farewell to a woman who fought for equal rights all her life. Lena Horne died this week. She was 92. During her long career as an actor, singer, and dancer, Lena Horne was an outspoken civil rights activist. When she entertained the troops in Europe during World War II, she refused to perform in front of a segregated audience. The result? Integration was allowed for one night for her military concerts. Lena Horne also broke barriers for African Americans in film, television, and on the Broadway stage. She was a woman ahead of her time.
They sure did ring that bell. Ain't it the gossip pearl true? It's the truth, the truth. It's the solid mellow truth.
And now, meet Zimbabwean singer Prudence Mabena. More on that after a quick break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire.
Winner is music by Prudence, Roger Ross Williams, and Eleanor Burkett.
There were cheers around the globe when this year's Oscar for Best Short Documentary went to a small film called Music by Prudence. It highlights the amazing resilience and accomplishments of a young woman from Zimbabwe named Prudence Mabena. Prudence is severely disabled, but she can sure sing. That voice is at the center of the film by director Roger Ross Williams. We caught up with Roger and Prudence last week in Los Angeles. Roger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
How did you first hear about Prudence?
I first heard about Prudence from a neighbor who told me about the band, and I started writing to the school where she attends called King George the Sixth School for Children with Disabilities. They sent me some footage. I remember very distinctly the moment I watched the footage, and I burst into tears. I was so moved by Prudence and the band's, their music and her message, that I felt I had to make this film.
What drew you to her story enough to make you want to do this documentary?
Prudence's spirit and her positive energy, and the music is so uplifting. And when you first see them perform, you think, oh, here's a group of disabled musicians, and you feel sorry for them. And then you quickly forget that they're disabled within minutes of hearing them perform, because their music is so good. And they don't see themselves as objects of pity. They see themselves as musicians, and they send a very positive message to their audience that they are happy and they're not complaining. So why should anyone else?
It is hard watching the documentary not to feel somewhat sad, even though Prudence is amazingly positive, not to feel sad about what happened to her. Tell us, if you would, a little bit about Prudence's story.
Yes, in Zimbabwe, disabilities are often considered witchcraft, the family is considered cursed, and children are cast off by their families. They're often hidden away so that the family basically doesn't want anyone to know that they have a disabled child. If you touch a disabled child, you will have a disabled child. There's all kinds of crazy sort of superstitions around disability. And Prudence lived a life, she was abandoned by her parents, and she lived a life with her stepmother, and that was pretty horrific. She was left to her own devices to eat off the ground and not taken to the bathroom, and she was compared to an ant. And she thought she was an ant because she was treated like an ant. And she used music, even singing to herself, to overcome those rough times. And during those rough times, told herself that life wouldn't always be so bad, that someday it would get better.
What disability was Prudence born with, and how has it affected her mobility?
Prudence was born with arthrogryposis, and it's a disability that affects the joints. And she was born with her arms and her legs bended behind her body, and her legs were amputated at a young age, and her arms are barely sort of usable. She can't feed herself. She can use a few fingers to operate a joystick on her electric wheelchair. So life is pretty challenging for Prudence, but she doesn't let that get her down or stop her, because Prudence, it's about her ability, not her disability, and Prudence is very independent.
You talked with her parents, you interviewed them for the documentary. What did they say about all of this?
I think that her mother and her father were pretty much in denial. The father didn't say much and was pretty distant. And her mother told the story of her birth, and she said the moment when Prudence was born, how she had felt that she was cursed by God, and how she was looking around at the other women and they had babies who were normal, she said. And she said no one would talk to her, no one would look at her, and she was all alone. And she didn't know what to do. So in a way, you sort of felt sorry for her mother, but then her mother turned around and left and went to South Africa to work. So she ended up abandoning Prudence as well. The pressure on women who have disabled children is so great, it's hard for them not to sort of break under that pressure.
Let's talk to Prudence. She's there in the studio with you. Prudence, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, I would like for you to pick up where Roger left off. Your music has really changed your life, hasn't it?
Yeah, I would say that music brings peace, because even when I got hurt when I was young, I would sing, and music changed my life.
There's a song in the documentary that I think maybe is about the power of music in your life. Let's play this song. Prudence, what are you singing about there? And by the way, that's a beautiful song. Your voice is
Thank
lovely.
Thank you. That song is a lullaby that I was taught by my grandmom when I was the age of 4. My grandmom used to sing the song whenever I cried. My grandmom would sing the song. And it actually says, hush, baby, don't cry. Your mom will come one day. I used to sing it whenever I got hurt. I would sing that song to comfort myself.
Is your grandmother still alive, Prudence?
My grandmom is still alive, yeah.
Can you describe for us a little the role she played in your life as a very young girl?
She was everything in my life. She's the one who made me believe in myself.
And she taught you to sing. In fact,
yeah.
I think you have recorded a song where you and your grandmother are singing together. Let's listen to that.
Masebe,
bizwa phezulu bebizwa phezulu ngizoba khona.
She's the one who made me have faith that one day I'll also be with someone. And I think I wouldn't be where I am without my grandmom, because she put that faith in me.
After things didn't work out with your dad and stepmother, I know you went to live at the school for disabled children, which was really your salvation in a way. You started singing there in the choir, and you got involved in a band. You're the lead singer of your band. It's called the Leanna Band. There are eight of you. All of you are disabled. What have the members of this band meant to you over the years?
I take them as my brothers. Those guys are so interesting. You know, they also were involved in so much challenges in their lives, and sharing those stories, it makes me feel at home. I feel that, okay, fine, I'm not the only one who was treated that way. So they are also a comfort in my life.
Let's listen to a song with you and your band. What a great song. What are you singing about?
This song is a comforting song for our country. It says, don't cry, Zimbabwe. Even if I don't mention the country name, but it says, don't cry, God shall conquer for you.
Does your faith play a big role in your life and your music?
Yes, I would say that if I didn't have faith, I wouldn't be here by now. So I also had faith that one day God will answer my prayers.
What were your prayers?
My prayers were to at least be seen as someone important in life, not to be seen as someone useless, not to be seen as someone who's a burden. So now I think God has actually answered my prayers.
You're giving concerts now, and what is it like when you're performing on stage and you can tell that your music is really touching people?
I feel special. Whenever I perform, I see that I'm also useful in life. I make people smile. I make people happy. I create joy in other people's lives. That's so amazing. You know, I feel great. I think that it's a very big role to be able to change other people's lives through music.
Roger, have you been surprised at all by this Oscar win and the reaction to the film?
I've been completely amazed because after winning the Oscar, Prudence returned to Zimbabwe to amazing fanfare. Hundreds of members of the media showed up. And as Prudence was carried down off the plane when the plane landed, and there at the foot of the steps of the plane, on his knees, tears streaming down his face, was her father begging for forgiveness. It was quite an amazing moment. Prudence had to deal with her parents coming back now and asking her for forgiveness. And I think that's really tough because we all want the love of our parents, even if they abandoned us.
Prudence, can you describe what that was like for you?
That was the most tough moment because I never thought that my own parents would one day ask for forgiveness for what they did. And, you know, it was very tough. Though I have forgiven them, I think it will be very hard for me to forget the life that I went through.
Is this a good thing for you?
I feel that if I hadn't become famous, maybe they wouldn't be communicating with me or making sure that I'm okay or not, you know. So I'm not sure.
What do you hope to do next with your music, Prudence?
To tour America. I love this place. And also, talking about disability, talking about how we have to be treated, that we have to be treated like human beings. We shouldn't be treated as people who are useless.
I mean, Prudence is now the most famous woman in Zimbabwe. Prudence was met by the mayor of Bulawayo, the second largest city in Zimbabwe, at the airport, put into a Rolls Royce and taken to City Hall, where a huge celebration was thrown in her honor. But what she's done is that, what this movie has done, is that it has changed sort of the way Zimbabweans approach the disabled in a way, because the top two leading newspapers in Zimbabwe wrote editorials that said Zimbabweans must change the way they view the disabled, that they've learned from Prudence's story. So hopefully there'll be some actual policy change in Zimbabwe and maybe even a Disabilities Act. And Prudence is here as an advocate to learn from the disability community in America how to be an advocate and how to advocate for the rights of the disabled.
Prudence, do you have a favorite song that's featured in the documentary about your life?
My favorite song is the lullaby that my grandma used to sing for me.
And you already sang that one, right?
Yes. The other song that I like in the movie is Itembalami, which says, "My hope is in you, Father," meaning God.
Let's play this song. Speaking with Prudence Mabena and film director Roger Ross Williams. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The documentary Music by Prudence is airing this month on HBO. It'll be released on DVD later this summer. Like Prudence, Karam Salem turned to music for comfort. It got him through some tough times after he left Iraq. The war forced Karam Salem to take refuge in Syria. He lost his home and his beloved piano. But the young Iraqi refugee made his way to the U.S., and now he's studying music at Holy Cross College in Indiana. This is Karam's story, in his own words. The music you'll hear is his original composition called Bridges.
The signs that I was receiving until the last moment, even in Syria, when I was in Syria, I mean, God keep on telling me, hey, you can make it. Hey, don't give up, don't give up. I'm a Chaldanian Catholic. We respect the different religions. In my neighborhood, we used to have a church. We used to have a mosque in my neighborhood. And it's very mixed between, I mean, Muslims and Christians. We didn't have really any problem. When I was 12 years old, there was a competition through the French Cultural Center in Iraq, and I've been only playing piano for 1 year, so I just participate for the competition, just for fun. I mean, just to say that I participate in a competition. But I didn't know it's going to be end up with having the third place in the competition. So I was surprised. I had my piano, it was so easy. It was like my toy. When I was cry, I was just go and play on my piano. When I was happy, I go play. So, I mean, because I was always referring to the piano as in she, as my girl, and always telling my mom that I will never get married because I already have her with me. So it was so hard to leave it. It's just like something going out from my heart, from my spirit, you could put it in this way. I had no idea about what is the concept of being in war until the war in 2003, because we left Baghdad. I think after that, I start to compose music just to change everything I've been known bad to something good. When I sit on my chair and try to put my fingers on the piano, I just think about the last person in the hall or among the audience. And how can I reach him? I mean, I think about the last person, how to reach him. Spiritually, physically. I don't think about the first one who's sitting just beside me.
That was Iraqi refugee and piano student Karam Salem in his own words. It was produced by Marian Myers. And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can download a podcast on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymeyer.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, Building a Better World for Children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
I was born to bless the Minecraft from the get-go. Never try to imitate or claim I was all ghetto. I was raised with love to the maximum. So I make sure I spread it even though it's gone. Amongst my peers, my elders and the younger ones. I miss the days of the old, all nice and fun. When you didn't have nine year olds running with guns. Now we're caught in a battlefield, everyone analyzing, trying to understand where it all begun. I mean, what's the deal? Father failed son? Who's to blame when the values get torn? Shredded to pieces and treated with scorn. Left to run away with no one to mourn. A generation that will see the beauty of a new dawn.